The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
the Dagoba Group, a global diversity and inclusion consulting practice
with specialties in unconscious bias,
leadership dynamics, and client engagement. Authors of the book, The Inclusion Dividend.
More at thedagobagroup.com.
And
Northeast Credit Union,
helping their members save money through free checking accounts
and refinancing of auto,
home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union,
encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org.
Federally insured by NCUA.
Equal housing opportunity.
And Dartmouth Hitchcock,
creating a new model for healthcare,
where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us.
A sustainable system,
improving the health of our communities for years to come.
Information at
imagine.d-h.org.
I'm Virginia Prescott. Today, NHPR and the Music Hall present Writers on a New England Stage with Salman Rushdie, recorded live at the Music Hall in Portsmouth. The Booker Award-winning novelist, author of four nonfiction books, children's books, story collections, and essays, joined us to talk about his 12th novel, 2 years, 8 months, and 28 days. It's a fantasy, a fairy tale for grown-ups, which, as he told us at the Music Hall, may be his weirdest book, adding, "I'm no stranger to weird." It's a story of the War of the Worlds, an epic battle between humans and the djinn, of which the singular djinni is where the word genie comes from. It's a conflict between superstition and reason, the supernatural and science. And it plays out in New York City and around the world on a mass scale, like a summer blockbuster. Salman Rushdie stepped on stage at the Music Hall in Portsmouth to introduce us to these magical djinn beings. Here he is, reading from 2 years, 8 months, and 28 nights.
Very little is known, though much has been written about the true nature of the djinn. The creatures made of smokeless fire. Whether they are good or evil, devilish or benign, such questions are hotly disputed. These qualities are broadly accepted, that they are whimsical, capricious, wanton, that they can move at high speed, alter their size and form, and grant many of the wishes of mortal men and women should they so choose, or if by coercion they're obliged to do so, and that their sense of time differs radically from that of human beings. They are not to be confused with angels. Even though some of the old stories erroneously state that the devil himself, the fallen angel, Lucifer, son of the morning, was the greatest of the djinn. For a long time, their dwelling places were also in dispute. Some ancient stories said slanderously that the djinn lived among us here on earth, the so-called lower world, in ruined buildings and many insalubrious zones, garbage dumps, graveyards, outdoor latrines, sewers, and wherever possible, in dunghills. According to these defamatory tales, we would do well to wash ourselves thoroughly after any contact with a djinni. They are malodorous and carry disease. However, the most eminent commentators long asserted what we now know to be true, that the djinn live in their own world, separated from ours by a veil, and this upper world, sometimes called Peristan or Fairyland, is very extensive, though its nature is concealed from us. To say that the djinn are inhuman may seem to be stating the obvious, but human beings share at least some qualities with their fantastical counterparts. In the matter of faith, for example, there are adherents among the djinn of every belief system on earth, and there are djinn who do not believe, for whom the notion of gods and angels is strange in the same way as the djinn themselves are strange to human beings. And though many djinn are amoral, at least some of them do know the difference between good and evil, between the right hand and the left hand path. Some of the djinn can fly, but some slither on the ground in the form of snakes or run about barking and baring their fangs in the shape of giant dogs. In the sea and sometimes in the air as well, they assume the outward appearance of dragons. Some of the lesser djinn are unable, when on earth, to maintain their form for long periods. These amorphous creatures sometimes slide into human beings through the ears, nose, or eyes and occupy those bodies for a while, discarding them when they tire of them. The occupied human beings, regrettably, do not survive. The female djinn, the Jinnias or Jinniri are even more mysterious, even subtler and harder to grasp, being shadow women made of fireless smoke. There are savage Jinniri and Jinniri of love, but it may also be that these two different kinds of Jinnia are actually one and the same, that a savage spirit may be soothed by love, or a loving creature roused by maltreatment to a savagery beyond the comprehension of mortal men. This is the story of a Jinnia, a great princess of the Jinn, known as the Lightning Princess on account of her mastery over the thunderbolt, who loved a mortal man long ago in the 12th century, as we would say, and of her many descendants, and of her return to the world after a long absence, to fall in love again, at least for a moment, and then to go to war. It is also the tale of many other jinn, male and female, flying and slithering, good, bad, and uninterested in morality, and of the time of the crisis, the time out of joint, which we call the time of the strangenesses, which lasted for 2 years, 8 months, and 28 nights, which is to say 1,000 nights and one night more. And yes, we have lived another 1,000 years since those days, but we are all forever changed by that time. Whether for better or worse, that is for our future to decide. Well, that's the beginning of the book. I thought I'd just read you a passage from later to introduce you to the bad jinn. The bad jinn are really bad. And the worst of them is this giant called Zumurrud Shah, the most terrifying of the jinn, who becomes involved with this conservative Islamic philosopher of the 11th century called Al-Ghazali, who is himself a rather terrifying creature, perhaps a precursor of what today we would call fundamentalists. Anyway, they make a strange and terrifying pair. This is how they get together. The grand Ifrit, Zumurrud Shah, on whose head was a golden crown taken from the head of a prince he had accidentally, or not so accidentally, decapitated once upon a time, had at a certain point in history become the philosopher Ghazali's personal jinni, a terrifying entity whose name was too scary to utter. Ghazali was not, however, the jinni's master. The words master and servant are inappropriate when applied to the relationship between human beings and the jinn. For any service a jinni may perform for a human being is a boon rather than evidence of enslavement, an act of generosity, or in the case of a jinni liberated from some sort of trap, a lamp, for example, a gesture of gratitude. The story goes that Ghazali had in fact freed Zumurrud Shah from just such a trap, a blue bottle in which a forgotten sorcerer had trapped him. Long, long ago, wandering the streets of his native city of Tus, Ghazali had spotted the opaque bottle lying abandoned in the heaps of trash which unfortunately disfigured that old town of salmon minarets and enigmatic walls, and had intuited at once the presence of a captive spirit therein. He scooped up the bottle casually, but with the guilty expression of a novice burglar, and pressing his lips against the royal blue glass, whispered a little too loudly the occult incantation that is the required opening for all dialogues with captured jinn. Jinni great and jinni grand, now I hold you in my hand. Tell me, ere I set you free, what reward you'll offer me. A miniaturized jinni speaking through glass sounds like a talking mouse in a cartoon. Many human beings have been deceived by this feeble squeakety-squeak. Ghazali, however, was made of sterner stuff. This was the jinni's reply. Never bargain. Let me go. Weak men bargain. Strong men know. Those who freely set me free evermore will blessed be. But Ghazali knew the proper retort to this childish deception. Well, I know your tribe and kin. Make your promise while you're in. Without a sacred vow to keep, only fool lets jinni leap. Zumurrud Shah, knowing he had little choice, offered the usual three wishes formula. Ghazali replied, sealing the contract, excepting in words that deviated somewhat from the usual. Any time, neath any moon, I may ask you for a boon. Any time, these 1, 2, 3, swiftly will fulfilled be. Released, expanding at once to his full immensity, the genie was struck by 2 things that marked out Ghazali as a most unusual mortal. Firstly, he did not quail. Quailing was not only de rigueur, it was also in most cases the instinctive reaction to the sight of Zumurrud the Great in his dark glory. However, this mortal, the Grand Ifrit noted with some perplexity, quaileth not. That was firstly, and secondly, he didn't ask for something right away. That was unprecedented. Infinite wealth, a bigger sexual organ, unlimited power, these wishes were at the top of any genie's list of the top demands of the human male. The human male wishing mind was surprisingly unimaginative. But no wish? The deferral of all 3 wishes? That was almost indecent. You ask for nothing? Zumurrud Shah roared. Nothing is a thing I cannot give. Ghazali inclined his philosopher's head and put a hand around his chin. I see that you give to nothing the quality of a thing. Nothing is the thing that cannot be given, precisely because it is not a thing. Yet in your view, its not thingness is itself a form of thingness. This perhaps we may discuss. Understand, Ginny, that I am a man of few personal needs. I need neither infinite wealth, nor a bigger sexual organ, nor unlimited power. However, the time may come when I ask for some larger service. I'll let you know. In the meantime, be off, you're free to go. When will this time come? Zumurrud Shah demanded. I'm going to be busy, you know. After being stuck in that bottle for so long, there are many things to be done. The time will come when it's time, Ghazali said infuriatingly, and turned away to his book. I spit upon all philosophers, Zumurrud Shah told him, also artists and the rest of humanity as well. And he whirled himself into a funnel of rage and was gone.
You're listening to Salman Rushdie, reading live on stage from 2 Years, 8 Months, and 28 Nights. He was recorded live at the Music Hall in Portsmouth for Writers on a New England Stage, a co-production of the Music Hall and NHPR.
Time passed. Years passed. Decades passed. And Ghazali was dead. And with him died the contract, or so the genie believed. And the slits between the worlds silted up and closed. And Zumurrud in Paristan, which is fairyland, forgot for a time all about the world of men, all about the man who refused to make a wish. And centuries passed, and a new millennium began, and the seals which separated the worlds began to break, and then boom, here he was again in the world of these feeble beings. And suddenly, there was a voice in his head commanding his presence, the voice of a dead man, the voice of dust, of less than dust, the voice of the void where the dust of the dead man had been, a void that had somehow become animated, somehow possessed of the sensibility of the dead man, a void that was ordering him to present itself to be told its first great wish. And he, having no option, being bound by the contract, even though he intended to argue that the contract did not apply posthumously, he remembered Ghazali's unusual language. Any time, neath any moon, any time, these 1, 2, 3. And he knew that, as he had forgotten to include a death clause, a detail he should make it a point to remember, if at any point in the future he needed to grant the 3 wishes contract again, the obligation still lay upon him like a shroud, and he had to do whatever the void desired. He remembered and summoned up in a rush all his unassuaged rage, the wrath of a grand ifrit who has spent half an eternity bottled up in blue, and conceived the desire to be avenged against the entire species from which his captor came. He would rid himself of this puny obligation to a dead man, and then it would be time for vengeance. This he swore. Zumurrud had a deep contempt for human character. It was as if he took the complexity of human beings as a personal affront, the maddening inconsistency of human beings, their contradictions which they made no attempt to wipe out or reconcile, their mixture of idealism and greed, grandeur and pettiness, truth and lies. They were not to be taken seriously any more than a cockroach deserves serious consideration. At best, they were toys. And he was as close as any of them would get to a wanton god, and he would, if he so chose, kill them for his sport. In other words, even if the philosopher Ghazali had not unleashed upon him the unsuspecting world, he would have unleashed himself upon it. His inclination was in accordance with his instructions, but the instructions from the dead philosopher were clear. Instill fear, Ghazali told him. Only fear will move sinful man towards God. Fear is a part of God in the sense that it is that feeble creature, man's appropriate response to the infinite power and punitive nature of the Almighty. One may say that fear is the echo of God, and wherever that echo is heard, men fall to their knees and cry mercy. In some parts of the earth, God is already feared. Don't bother about those regions. Go where man's pride is swollen, where man believes himself to be godlike. Lay waste his arsenals and flesh pots, his temples of technology, knowledge, and wealth. Go also to those sentimental locations where it is said that God is love. Go and show them the truth. I don't have to agree with you about God, replied Zumurrud Shah, about his nature or even his existence. That is not and never will be my business. In Fairyland, we do not speak of religion, and our daily life there is utterly alien to life on earth, and if I may say so, far superior. I can tell that even in death, you are a censorious prude. So I will not go into details, even though they are juicy. At any rate, philosophy is a subject of no interest except to bores, and theology is philosophy's more tedious cousin. I'll leave such soporific matters to you in your dusty grave. But as to your wish, I not only accept it as my command, it will be my pleasure to comply. With the proviso that as you are in fact asking for a series of acts, this will redeem the entirety of my three wishes pledge. Agreed, the void that had been Ghazali replied. If the dead could giggle with delight, then the dead philosopher would have chortled with glee. The genie perceived this. Why so mirthful? He inquired. Unleashing chaos upon the unsuspecting world is not a joke, or is it? Ghazali was thinking of his old adversary, Ibn Rushd. My adversary in thought, he told Zumurrud Shah, was a poor fool who was convinced that with the passage of time, human beings would turn from faith to reason in spite of all the inadequacies of the rational mind. I obviously am of a different mind. I have triumphed over him many times, yet our argument continues, and it is a fine thing in a battle of wits to be in possession of a secret weapon to fire, an ace in the hole to play, a trump card to use at an opportune time. In this particular case, mighty Zumurrud, you are that trump. I relish the fool's imminent discomfiture and his further inevitable defeat. Philosophers are children, the genie said, and I've never liked children myself. He departed in scorn, but the time would come when he returned to Ghazali to listen to what the dead man's dust had to say. The time would come when he was less contemptuous of religion and of God.
I put a spell on you. Because you're mine.
Author Salman Rushdie reading there about a debt that launches a war between the magical genie beings and the human race that lasts 2 years, 8 months, and 28 days. That's the title of his new novel. He was recorded live at the Music Hall in Portsmouth for Writers on a New England Stage. I'm Virginia Prescott, and this is Writers on a New England Stage with Salman Rushdie, recorded live at the Music Hall in Portsmouth. a co-production of NHPR and The Music Hall. Rushdie has been knighted, prestigiously awarded, and frequently recognized as one of our greatest living writers. Yet he may still be best known as the target of a 1989 fatwa calling for his assassination on charges that his novel, The Satanic Verses, insulted Islam. Rushdie became a symbol for freedom of expression while on the run. He recounted almost a decade in exile in his memoir, Joseph Anton. He followed that harrowing history up with a fairy tale. Salman Rushdie joined me on stage at the Music Hall for an interview, and I included questions from the live audience and some submitted on social media. We talked about 2 years, 8 months, and 28 days, which add up to 1,001 nights. Do you first remember hearing those tales?
Yeah, I mean, these were children's stories that we were told, you know, and although actually they're not children's stories. I mean, if you read the real book, they're not at all. They're not written for children. They're written in very adult, complex language, and they're adult stories, exactly as, you know, the Grimm stories were not written for children. Those were adult folk tales that got turned into children's versions. But yeah, I heard them first. I mean, the first time I heard about the djinn, you know, was in the form of like scary bedtime stories.
Mm-hmm. Did you think they were magic?
Yeah, I did.
Your first superhero, sort of?
Yes. I mean, well, there was also Superman and Batman, but they were American. You know, the djinn were local.
And love is rare in the djinn world, but sex is incessant.
Sex is nonstop, yeah.
Is this your addition to the cosmology?
Well, there is some stuff about the lecherous nature of the djinn, but I wanted them to have one characteristic that was just ridiculous and funny. And I think, you know, the role of sex in novels is to be absurd and comic, sometimes unintentionally. But I think certainly in this book, the ludicrous sexual appetite of the djinn is presented as a sign of their sort of cultural bankruptcy, because there isn't that much to do in fairyland. There's no books to read. There's no movies to go and see. There's no computer games in fairyland. All they have is sex.
And lots of it.
And after a couple of 100,000 years, that can get dull.
But
and
still,
they like human beings because we're more interesting than them, because we do things other than have sex. In fact, most of us hardly have sex.
But when the War of the Worlds comes, this leads to a problem. Things get pretty amped up when the female djinn boycotts sex.
There's a kind of Lysistrata moment where the female djinn, in order to try and stop the male djinn from doing terrible things, try and deny them sex, but it just makes them mad.
It makes them mad, and they're human minions on Earth.
Yeah.
That's what amps them up. They become violent.
Yeah,
so do you think that's the root of terrorism, Salman
Well,
Rushdie?
I think so. Well, you know, in the novel, it is suggested that it might be, but that's what we in the trade call a joke. but I mean, it's a joke with an edge, you know. I mean, I think there's a lot of suicide bombers who are virgins. You know, there's a lot of young men picking up guns because they can't have an ordinary life and raise a family and so on. You know, so like all jokes, it's got a little bite of truth, I hope.
Well, there's a rivalry between Ibn Rushd, if I'm saying that properly,
yeah,
and Ghazali that goes on for centuries. First when they're alive,
and then when they're dead.
And yeah, these piles of dust.
I wasn't planning that to happen, really. I mean, I had initially thought that there would be this 12th century prologue to the novel in which these philosophers would argue, and in which one of them, Ibn Rushd, would have this love affair with the djinn princess. And then we would leap 9 centuries to the present day with the descendants of the love affair, and the story would continue. And then I just thought, when I started these two old geezers arguing, I thought it was too much fun. I thought, I don't want to stop, this is too good. So I've got to find a way for them to go on, even when they've been dead for 900 years. And so somehow their dust animates, and they go on arguing from inside the grave where they aren't even there anymore because it's so long ago, the empty space where they were, begins to argue with the empty space where the other one was. And this you could do in a novel.
It's one of my favorite lines, because they're both piles of decaying bone, and so that when they speak, it's dust to dust.
Exactly.
But they both actually existed.
They're both real people, yeah. And I mean, obviously, that part's not true, I don't think.
They didn't speak to each other long after.
I don't think so. But yeah, I mean, what we know about them is, I mean, the novel is true to that, that Ghazali lived in what was then Persia and wrote a book called The Incoherence of the Philosophers, in which he attacked the kind of philosophy out of which Ibn Rushd's ideas developed, which was Aristotelian, and which basically tried to privilege reason and logic and science above blind faith. And anyway, Ghazali attacked that. And Ibn Rushd in his time wrote a reply to Ghazali's book, which was wonderfully called The Incoherence of the Incoherence.
I was convinced you'd made that up.
No, it's really called that. And he argued on behalf of reason and logic and science, etc. And in his time, 12th century, he was in Spain, lived in Cordova, which was the capital of the Moorish kingdom of Spain. And he was very eminent. He was a court philosopher. He was the court physician. But he was persecuted by the fanatics of his time, who were Berber Arabs. And there was a period for which he was fired and driven into exile. Mm-hmm. And his books were burned. I thought, I know somebody else to whom that happened.
Sounds a little familiar.
And then he was rehabilitated and ended his life, you know, back in favor. I thought, you know, oddly, not only are our names alike, but we have rather similar stories, and so I got very interested in him. So he becomes this sort of voice of reason in the book.
So are you, in some ways, carrying on his work?
Well, I think accidentally, yeah. I mean, when the trouble started around my work, I realized how much in common what happened to me had with what happened to him. I thought, well, yeah, it's the right flag to be sailing under, if you like.
I'm Virginia Prescott, and you're listening to my conversation with Salman Rushdie for Writers on a New England Stage, a co-production of The Music Hall and NHPR.
Speaking of the battle for reason, there are a number of questions here about your thoughts on the GOP candidates' comments of anti-Muslim rhetoric, especially Ben Carson, I'm thinking, Donald Trump.
Yeah.
Any thoughts?
You know, we have to take seriously Ben Carson and Donald Trump. Okay. Well, Ben Carson, I said it the other day, but I'll say it again, seems to me like Clarence Thomas running for president. Except that he talks a little more.
Maybe he'll speak more.
He talks a little more. And Donald Trump, I mean, I don't know, I'm hoping that the implosion of Donald Trump has begun. Because, for a minute, I thought he was just funny and added to the gaiety of nations and guaranteed the defeat of the Republican Party, and all of these are good things. But I think he's sort of not funny. I think he's enabled a kind of racist discourse in this country, which unfortunately there are plenty of people who actually seriously think like that. Mm. And I mean, it's a very ugly display so far. And I think what's odd is that nobody has really emerged as a serious candidate. You know, I mean, Carly Fiorina, really? I was on Real Time with Bill Maher with Carly Fiorina, and she struck me as one of the really stupidest panelists that I'd ever been on with.
Don't hold back.
No, I mean, holding back has never been my gig, you know. But I think, you know, I mean, I read in the paper yesterday that when she was CEO of Hewlett-Packard, she was illegally selling computers to Iran. And given her hostility to Iran and the deal and so on, it's rather interesting that she was sanctions busting by selling them computers, which they're presumably using right now. That's a president?
Well, selling arms to Iran,
yeah,
being
who did
a president.
That? Exactly. Yeah, exactly.
Doesn't compute. No. You know, but there are a number of questions from people here, and also we got a lot on the internet about the Iran deal. People want to know your opinion on the Iran deal. They want to know about ISIS. But I'm wondering this for you. You know, you You're the person who is called on when the U.S. Embassy is attacked over the innocence of Muslims or Charlie Hebdo is attacked. I mean, do you want to be that person?
I don't want to be that guy. Hitchens wanted to be that guy and did it very well. I mean, I don't want to be the kind of talking head who's wheeled out. The idea of a talking head being wheeled out is not attractive. But, you know, I mean, this is who I am. I didn't get into this business to be a pontificator on contemporary politics. I got into it to tell stories. And, you know, it's taken me, took me a long time to get out of that particular jam and get back to the writing of stories. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, one of the great pleasures of this book is it's the first adult novel I've written for, you know, whatever it is, 7.5 years. I don't have any original views on these things. You know, I have the same views as you. I'm suspicious of the deal, but I think that war hasn't worked. Well, let's try peace. Maybe it'll work, maybe it won't. I don't know, you know. I'm not privy to these discussions. I'm a novelist.
But you're writing about things that, you know, the fundamentalism bad, secularism
good.
True.
No, look, I mean, I think what's true, I don't want to be disingenuous about this. It's clear that when you write this kind of a fable, you are also trying to say something about the world as it is. You know, and I think clearly this book has a vision of the world as it is. And in that world, there is the darkness that we all know. And clearly the book is trying to examine that, yes. But the reason why it's not written as realism, which it could have been, is partly that I thought, you know, the news is doing that job anyway. And partly because I thought I wanted to reach for something a little below the news, you know, in order to say that, yes, at the moment, the conflict takes this particular form and it's very brutal and savage and unpleasant and depressing. But this conflict between peace and war, between reason and unreason, between the rational and the irrational, you know, that's the story of the human race. That conflict has always been going on, and it's not only external, it's also internal. That, you know, we all have inside us something irrational as well as something rational, and that constant, you know, that's an argument inside us. Mm. I mean, here's me, you know, I'm this rational atheist writer who writes about jinn and fairies and magic, and there's possibly a contradiction there. And I mean, I have no defense except the famous defense of Walt Whitman, where he said, "Do I contradict myself? Very well, I contradict myself."
So in the book, Dunya, who is Ibn Rushd's young lover, there are so many strong women in your books, including Dunya. Are you a feminist?
Well, I'm certainly somebody who grew up around a lot of very strong women. You know, I mean, in my family, the girls outnumber boys by a lot. You know, I mean, I have 3 sisters, no brothers. And in my extended family of aunts and cousins and so on, there were not more female than male. And they were all, I mean, everybody, every woman in my family is colossally noisy, opinionated, you know, and really difficult. And you know, if you want to get a hearing, you know, in my family, you have to shout them down and you have to have something interesting to say, otherwise go away, you know. That starts with my grandma. My grandmother was very small and absolutely terrifying. And I'll just tell you this little story about that, my grandmother, which will show you. Is that when I graduated from Cambridge in the impossibly distant year 1968, I'll show you how distant it was. I drove from England to India with an English friend in a Mini. And we drove across, for example, Turkey, Iran, Afghanistan. And the world was such that you could do that then. Anyway, so after this long trip of many months, you know, I arrive a little dusty and shaggy, unshaven, long-haired. I had hair then. And my grandmother, I arrived at my parents' home, and my grandmother sitting there in the living room, and she completely refused to acknowledge my existence. And she turned to my sister there, and she said, "Tell your brother to wash." So I had to go to the bath, but I have like three showers to get all the mud off me, the mud of the journey off me. Then I came down all clean, and she turned to my sister, and she said, tell your brother to get his hair cut. So then I had to go, I just arrived home after having gone thousands of miles across the world, but then I had to go across the street to get a haircut. And when I came back with the haircut, she spread her arms and she said, my grandson has returned.
Salman Rushdie, a writer often described as a ladies' man, talking about one of the very strong women in his life, his grandmother. I'm Virginia Prescott, and this is Writers on a New England Stage with Salman Rushdie, recorded live at the Music Hall in Portsmouth, a co-production of NHPR and the Music Hall. Rushdie joined us to talk about 2 years, 8 months, and 28 nights, a fairy tale that pits secularism and reason against fear-based religious fervor. Like the ancient tales of 1001 Nights, a female character named Dunya in the novel tells stories to her lover, in this case, the real-life 12th-century philosopher Ibn Rushd. Dunya is a jinn, a member of the magical jinni race that genie derives from. Ibn Rushd describes to her the human notion of God's all-powerful, omniscient ways, which she thinks is stupid. Let's pick up the conversation from there with Salman Rushdie on stage at the Music Hall in Portsmouth. Do you believe that the faithful are stupid or less smart?
Can I take the fifth?
No, I'm afraid not.
Well, I think it's, you know, I think that God is an idea that human beings invented in order to explain things that they then did not understand. You know, and I think that the origin of the idea of God is to do with the question of origins. Where did we come from? How did we get here? How did here get here? And so you invent a sky god that makes it all. And then God became a very useful way of codifying morality, you know, commandments, etc. Do this, don't do that. And so you have religions which basically try to answer the question of origins and the question of ethics. I mean, that's what they do. And it seems to me that we now know, we don't know everything, but we know a lot more about the question of origins. And what one of the things we do know is that every story told by every religion is incorrect. That didn't happen. Whatever happened, that didn't happen. You know, 6 days resting on the seventh, no, that's not what happened. You know, churning the primal soup in a giant churn, which is the Hindu creation myth, that didn't happen. The world created, or the first beings created by the friction between the udders of a giant cow sleeping at the bottom of a bottomless pit, tossing in her sleep because she's having a bad dream, and her udders hit rocks, you know. That's the Nordic creation myth. You know, the human race created because of the sparks created by a cow's bad dream. That probably didn't happen. You know, so I don't look to religion to answer the question of origins. And I certainly don't look to, you know, priests to answer the question of ethics. I'd sooner answer those questions in another way. So I have no use for it, you know? I have no use for it. And where I differ from Hitchens is that Christopher believed religion was stupid and so were its adherents and it was just wrong and bad for you and terrible. And my view is this, that if people privately have a requirement for religious faith, it's not my business, you know? I mean, I may think it's like believing that the world is flat or that the moon is made of green cheese, which I sort of do believe it is, like that. But it's not my business, you know? I mean, if people get whatever they get from it, get nourishment or succor or comfort, you know, fine. When it becomes public business, when religion moves into the public arena, I mean, see Kim Davis, which we're not going to talk about, then it's everybody's business. You know, that, and I think the thing that's happened in the last few decades is that religion has moved right back into the center of the room and become an enormously powerful public force. And that, I think, is extremely harmful and has proven itself to be extremely harmful.
Well, and was extremely detrimental to your life, certainly, and a number of people ask questions about that. But I'm wondering, like, is it time to stop talking about the fatwa?
Yes, it's time. I mean, the reason I wrote that 650-page book is that if you want to find out about it, it's all in there, you know? And it happened in 1989.
You know, that's, but things have gotten notably more radicalized since
yes,
then.
Yes, but that's your problem as well as mine. You know what I mean? There was a thing that happened to me 26 years ago that at the time felt exceptional and bizarre and got a lot of attention because it felt so exceptional and bizarre. But now, I mean, now it's happening to all of us. You know, now it's not just the story of me and what happened to me. Now it's how we all of us face up to this threat. You know, and so, yeah, it's time to stop talking about me and start talking about all of us and how we face up to this threat.
Well, how about a more personal question about you? Did living in fear affect your writing for the better, ultimately?
I don't know. I don't know. You have to tell me that. but what I think is this. If it were just the case that you knew nothing about my life, if you'd never heard of anything about my life, and all you had in front of you was a set of my books, and you were to read them in chronological order, I don't think you would see, or you, I don't think you would feel that something very odd happened after 1989. You know, I don't think there's a kind of rift in the work. You know, I think the work is, it's good or bad, you know, right or wrong, but the work is going down its own path. You know, and I just tried to go on being the writer that I always set out to be. You know, and I think, so in that sense, I tried very hard not to let it distort or deform my work. Because I could have written frightened books, I could have written revenge books. Both of those would have been, I thought, defeats for me, and in a way, victories for the attack against me, because that would have destroyed the kind of writer that I'd wanted to be. So I thought, don't do that, just go on, you know. And I think writers are very bloody-minded. And my view is, if somebody tries to shut me up, you know, talk louder. And so I tried to do, maybe that's what I'm doing, maybe I'm talking louder.
I'm Virginia Prescott, and you're listening to Salman Rushdie, recorded live at the Music Hall in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, for Writers on a New England Stage. Here's a question from the audience. In Midnight's Children, Salim says, "If small things go, will large things be left behind?" Could you explain this quote and how it might tie into issues facing the world today?
Well, I think it's in a way, it's not unrelated to what Arundhati Roy was talking about in her book, The God of Small Things. And I think it's something very relevant to the writing of books. If you don't get the little things right, the big things don't work. You know, I mean, human character is built out of small detail. You know, observation is very much about little things. You know, the way you hang your hat, the way you sing off key. That, you know, to be able to pinpoint detail is what it is to write. So yeah, if small things go, the big things disappear immediately afterwards because they lose value.
If you were granted three wishes from a genie,
what would they be?
And did not choose to immediately wish for more wishes, what would your three wishes be?
Well, I don't know. Those three awful wishes. They're not so bad.
Okay, next. One of the characters that I just loved in this book, Geronimo. In the time of the strangenesses, he starts to levitate.
And he's a gardener, so it's rather sad that he loses connection.
He can't touch the ground.
Can't touch the ground, yeah. The gardener who can't touch the ground.
But in his character, he left his home, born in Bombay, would never call it Mumbai, at a very young age, and was a migrant, you know, sort of floating around the world, and when brought back to his home, realizes that the consequences of his life, he could never go back there
yeah,
again.
Yeah, partly because he's changed, but also because it's changed.
It's changed.
You know, so, I mean, that's the thing about the well-known saying about you can't go home again, is not just that you can't buy a plane ticket and go, it's that when you get there, it's not the place you left.
But he is also the one who bears witnesses and is there to record what's going on. I wonder if there's any of you in Geronimo.
Yeah, no, there is. I mean, there is, because we share a number of things. We both grew up in the same city, although he's grows up in a place called part of Bombay called Bandra, which is a very Christian neighborhood, and he's actually the illegitimate child of a Catholic priest, a thing which never happens in real life. So he has a sort of different life background, but what we do share, and one of the reason for the whole thing about him coming detached from the earth, was that I wanted to talk about that, the loss of roots, alienation. And I've always felt, as a writer who has not been deeply rooted in one place, I've always felt that issue of the ground. And I wrote a novel called The Ground Beneath Her Feet, but that subject of the ground on which the work stands, you know, is something that I can't take for granted. You know, somebody who's born and raised in New York can take New York for granted. I have to build it before I can put people on it. You know, I have to create the ground that the book stands on. And then I thought that this idea of being tinily detached, you know, because he's only like this much off the ground, but to be half an inch off the ground is just as great a disruption of the law of gravity as being 20 feet in the sky. But funnier. And I just thought that would become a metaphor of that kind of rootless person, you know. And I mean, he was really the first character I had, and in many ways, it is sort of his book. I mean, he's the kind of heart of the book, I think. And yes, he has that in common. He has that sense of a loss, you know, a loss of the past. He also loses, his wife dies, you know, so he's also lost love. And I just think, you know, I think if you get to this age, loss is an inescapable subject. You know, I think we've all lost, you know, if we're not 16, and even if we are sometimes, we've all lost things that we loved, places that we loved, people that we loved. And we have to continue in spite of that, but you carry the loss with you. You know, so that's really where he came from as a character.
I want to tie together some of the things that you said. The djinn, they don't love fiction, they don't love art. You know, they're just living their lives in their own fruity way. And then also, one of the themes in this book is like the power of the story. A Thousand and One Nights is all about, you know, keeping alive, keeping the savage at bay by telling stories.
Yeah.
And then there's a period after the War of the Worlds where everything is peaceful and content, but there's no more imagination. So
yeah, I wanted to imagine an ending for the book which wasn't like fashionably dystopic. You know, it'd be so easy.
It's kind of
to
in right now.
Yeah, it'd be really easy to write a book in which everything is horrible and gets worse and ends terribly. And so I thought, let me try and think about what else might happen. And so, yeah, I think the ending of the book is kind of a better future than maybe we have any right to expect right now.
But without the magic, there's no imagination.
Then, you know, and that you know, one of the great, maybe the greatest lesson of fairy tales is be careful what you wish for. Mm. Because if you get it, you might discover it's still not what you want, which includes the larger sexual organ.
So instead, maybe, is your superpower telling stories?
Well, I mean, it was the only thing I ever wanted to do, and it's just my great good fortune to have been able to spend a lifetime doing the only thing I ever wanted to do.
Please do join me in a warm thank you for Sir Salman Rushdie. Sir Salman Rushdie, author of several novels, essays, a memoir, children's books, and most recently, The Fairy Tale, 2 years, 8 months, and 28 nights. He was recorded live at the Music Hall in Portsmouth for Writers on a New England Stage, a co-production of New Hampshire Public Radio and the Music Hall in Portsmouth in collaboration with Yankee Magazine and River Run Books. The executive producer and live stage presentation director is Patricia Lynch. NHPR's president is Betsy Gardella. Producer and communications director is Margaret Talcott. The live sound and recording and mixing engineer is Ian Martin. Bob Lord and Dreadnought provide live music. Broadcast producer for NHPR is Taylor Quimby. Digital producer is Sarah Plord. Music Hall production manager is Jana Morris. And photos from the event are posted online at Clear Eye Photo. You can also see the photos and listen to more author interviews from the series at wordofmouthradio.org. Click on the Writers on a New England Stage link. There you'll also find some of Salman Rushdie's tips for aspiring writers. I'm Virginia Prescott, and this has been a special broadcast of Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio.